Welcome back, everybody. Dr. Adam Sowley joins us today from the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Edinburgh. Having received his PhD from St. Andrews in June 2009, he then became a postdoctoral research fellow at the University College Dublin from 2008 to 2009. Focusing on the processes of state formation and state foreign behaviour in the Middle East, historical sociology, and the politics of state-like organisation, his current research addresses, in particular, themes of state survival in the Middle East, IR theory and foreign policy, and the political behaviour of Hezbollah. Today, he will be speaking to us about Arab state formations in the Arab Spring.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for the Society of Foreign Affairs for inviting me to give this talk, and I realize you're being very nervous, but the last time I came to this hall, I was also organizing a conference for the Center for Syrian Studies, and I was quite nervous too. And I think I messed up the organization because I left a Syrian academic in the airport for around 1 hour waiting for the taxi. So when he came, he was quite frustrated. I think this radicalized his view, and he instigated the Syrian uprising after that. No, I'm joking, of course. No, but thank you so much. Great organization. I'm very happy to be back in St. Andrews, I was going to say Edinburgh. Today, I want to focus on the origins and processes of regime erosion, but also precisely state formation processes. I think Andy trapped me in the defense of political science before he left, and I'll try not to get trapped too much, but despite his observations on PowerPoint presentations, I'm going to be using one. But just a few slides, and just to say, and this is not in reaction to Andy's thoughts about political science and IR, but I think given the chaos that is taking place in the Arab world at the moment, given what's happening in the media, we're all lost somehow, and given the excitement, freedom, revolution, etc., etc., it is time to put things into perspective. And I think you might agree or disagree, but political scientists, IR historians, students of sociology, whatever, are in a good position to do that. And it starts by really rethinking about some of the terms we use, trying to identify some of the processes that we observe as we trying to understand what's happening in the region. So I have this photo. It says something, but I'll get back to it later on. So freedom is a right, not a privilege. And I'll say why I chose that photo. However, the main question I'll try to answer today is, what are the origins and possible consequences of the latest political uprisings in the Arab world? I'll be doing this in three ways. First, I'll try to situate the revolutions in time and place, i.e. trying to give them some context, some history. Second, try to provide an explanation of the current revolutions. I'll precisely be looking at regime erosion and adaptation in the Middle East. Finally, I'll explore a few cases. And this is going to take around 40 minutes, so please bear with me. To start with, what are we talking about? Revolutions, uprisings, springs, winters, blood, etc. I will be very cautious in the choice of my words. I will be using the concept political uprisings, and I'll say why as we move on. One thing that comes to mind when we examine the Arab world, especially trying to observe what the press is talking about, it seems to us that this is a moment in history that is new, as if there is no history to what's going on in the region. And suddenly we're kind of stuck in the moment. And here I'll be agreeing with Andy, we need to go back to history, but in a structured way, not in a detailed oriented approach. So that's my point anyhow. I think if we were meeting here 50 or 60 years ago and discussing Middle East politics of the time, we would still be talking about revolutions. So 50 or 60 years ago, imagine 1958 or 1962, we would still be talking about revolution, because we did have revolutions. We had a Nasserite revolution in Egypt, then this generated other revolutions in Syria, in Yemen, in Libya, etc., etc. But there is a difference. Then we had social grievances, we had political problems, and regimes came from the top to express these grievances and to provide a solution for these grievances. So when we speak about regimes, it's very easy to talk about dictatorships, brutality, etc., etc. But from a historical sociology perspective, regimes are there to serve certain social interests, and that's what they came to do in the late mid-50s and late until the late 60s. However, that said, there is a general change taking place in the region. And I think if there is one thing that unites all of these uprisings, is a change at a normative level. And the change at a normative level means the political culture of the people in the region has shifted. If we were talking about revolutions 50 or 60 years ago, we'd be talking about a different kind of freedom. Primarily, we'd be talking about freedoms from colonial power, freedoms from colonial domination. Ideologies of the time tended to express just that. For example, this is an extract from Patrick Seale's biography of Hafez al-Assad, and he's more or less trying to define Michel Aflaq. Michel Aflaq is the ideologue behind the Ba'ath Party, and Ba'athist ideas, which shaped Assad's points of views and ideological outcome. This is what Patrick Seale says. He coined a three-word guide to action: unity, freedom, and socialism. So unity, as you would expect, was the necessary medicine for a sick and divided nation, i.e. the Arab world that was divided by colonial powers, as Andy tried to explain earlier on. So Arabs from the Atlantic to the Gulf belonged together because of bonds of history, religion, language, etc., etc. Freedom, on the other hand, was first conceived as freedom from foreign domination. So we weren't necessarily talking about individual freedoms or freedom from an authoritarian power. We were talking about a specific form of freedom. And when we talked about, or when they talked about freedom, individual freedom, they meant freedom from as a personal liberation of the individual from mental and social chains. So there is a Marxist underpinning thought here. Liberation, socialism provided the answer, and the biggest liberation was really aimed at foreign domination. That's not limited to Michel Afra or the Ba'athists. I thought it would be interesting to go back to Jamal Abdel Nasser's philosophy of the revolution, written a few years before the 1952 coup, which then developed into a whole revolution. And reading Nasser again, you realize the difference in the norms of the time. He talked about, I'm translating, so bear with me. For every people of the world, you have two kinds of revolutions. This is what he meant by revolution. A political revolution to regain the national independence of a nation, i.e. aimed at foreign powers and colonial powers. And the second one is a social revolution aimed at getting rid of the ruling classes. If you realize here, in these norms that were expressed in the 50s and 60s, the idea of individual freedom wasn't particularly important, or at least, not to exaggerate things, it wasn't particularly salient during that time. And that's true of several developing countries in Africa, Latin America, and Southeast Asia, etc., etc. So what has changed in the last 60 years? I think the main change has to do with the emergence of new norms. Now it's about individual liberty, but precisely in the Arab context, the issue of karama or dignity. This time, these political claims, these ideological claims, karama, dignity, or individual freedoms, are not targeting colonial powers, but they're targeting an authority that is local, i.e. domestic authoritarian regimes of the Arab world. Now, in my opinion, beyond this broad umbrella of political claims, the Arab world is quite divided. When we talk about the Arab Spring, it's like talking about Arabs in general. I think there's no such a thing as Arabs in political science, simply put. You want to understand Egypt? Study Mexico. You want to understand the regime of Ben Ali? Study Marcos in Philippines. The Arab world is part of a developing world that gained its independence quite late in time, and I'll elaborate on this. So the first thing to reconsider is to think about the Arab world as simply a world, a broad world, of different political regimes, different societies, etc., etc. Now, using the word revolution also, I think we need to go back to the big guys in the field who provide us with interesting indications. If I stand here and call what's happening in Syria as revolution, that could be the case, but it has symbolic power. Because if I say there is a revolution taking place, I've already defined the parameters of it, I've already defined the outcomes. And I would be sounding like a politician, because if Hillary Clinton is to stand here and say there is a revolution in Syria, that has consequences. It means Bashar al-Assad has no legitimacy, and hence we need to do something about it. As I'm not a politician, so I'll be more cautious in the concepts I use. So two concepts are to be defined here, although I'll be calling what's happening in the Arab world as uprisings. In the case of Tunisia and Egypt, I'll label them as revolution. However, we need to differentiate between two situations. A full revolution, I adapt Charles Tilly's definitions here, equals a revolutionary situation plus a revolutionary outcome. A revolutionary situation is a situation where two contenders make opposing claims to power. If you look at Syria now, that's what's precisely happening. You have a regime trying to survive in power. You have an opposition bringing forward new claims to power. And hence, there is a conflict. Now, support for these claims comes usually from segments from society. And the regime still has a segment of society that supports it. Again, in the case of Syria. And this tells us that we reach a situation where neither the opposition is able to overthrow the regime, nor the regime is able to suppress the opposition. So you have a revolutionary situation, not yet a revolution, and then the situation is open to different paths. It could end in civil war, prolonged civil war. It could end in a political solution that would facilitate regime change. That is as opposed to revolutionary outcomes, where you begin to notice defection of regime members. Remember in the Libya case, diplomats began to resign, as opposed to the Syrian case. Members of the Libyan army began to defect. Actually, they became the parts of the opposition, and now they're in power. So you begin to get these indicators of revolution, very similar to the Iran case of 1979. That so far hasn't happened in Syria, for instance. The army, to a large extent, is still consolidated. No diplomat has resigned. But on the other hand, the armed forces weren't neutralized as in the case of Egypt. In Egypt, it took the neutralization of the army to get rid of Hosni Mubarak. Once again, you can call this a full-fledged revolution. So the basic point I'm trying to make here is let's be careful in what terms we use and why we use them. Okay, how are we to understand the revolutions in the Arab world? Again, thinking about processes, taking history into consideration, leads us to think about the process of state-making in the region. As opposed to East Asia, where you had strong communist regimes, strong national states, Bulgaria, Romania, clear nation states. In the Arab world, that's not the case. And it's not the case because of the process of state formation. The way states were designed, mostly, and again, I totally agree with Andy, borders were totally imposed on a region, regardless of the social, ethnic, or sectarian basis of each country. So you had Iraq's borders being drawn, Syria's borders being drawn, and that frustrated many groups in the process. Then, when there was a gap in the international system, you had revolutionary regimes, populist regimes coming to power. Nasser in Egypt, the Baathists in Syria, Arab nationalists in Iraq and Yemen, etc., etc. Then eventually Gaddafi, who came late to the game at the age of 29 in 1969, and all making claims, trying to revolutionize their societies from above. That one common process among all of these states is in trying to establish new states, regimes had to monopolize three spheres as part of the state formation process. The first was, of course, coercion. Any process of state formation first involves the monopolization of coercion, which is true of Europe, Latin America, and other countries of the world. Second, you had to monopolize ideology. Otherwise, a new claimant to power would emerge and would threaten your ideological basis. Finally, you had to monopolize the economic resources present within a particular country. In many cases, it was about socialist development. So you had these three monopolizations taking place at one time. I will not elaborate on this a lot. However, it's important to note that in the process of monopolization, this generated a big response from within societies. Islamic groups were in totally frustrated. They were resisting these regimes. So the idea of political uprisings has been salient in the process of state making. What we're observing isn't particularly new as such. Second, one of the peculiar, to an extent peculiar, characteristics of the Middle East is that it continues to be a penetrated region. Penetrated by global powers. I mean, until now, you realize that political changes in the region did not take a uniform path. You had military intervention in Libya, which facilitated the removal of the regime. But before that, we forget, as we're talking about the current Arab Spring, we forget Iraq, where the process was quiet, similar to the case of Libya. You had the dictator alienating itself from society, the opposition unable to overthrow him. You get an external intervention, the regime is overthrown, and new political forces come to the fore. So that process again started in the 1950s when Nasser began to establish his socio-economic reforms. That wasn't what the British and French and the Israelis wanted, and hence there was war taking place in the region. And that's a continuing process that takes place until this moment. What weakened these regimes is the fear of the rivals coming to power, primarily their ideological rivals, but also any potential coming from the military. So just to give you a basic idea about this whole process which led to regime erosion in the world, in the Arab world, first you get authoritarian powers coming to the fore to establish independence in the 50s and 60s. Now, to get rid of their rivals, they simply use state organs, they build their own armies, militias, etc., etc. And then, however, as they're doing this, they create an opposition, they create enemies within the state, and then these enemies become vulnerable to external intervention. I.e., for instance, all opposition movements in the Arab world have tried to get an external patron to neutralize the power of the authoritarian regime and hence to get rid of him and come to power. So the moments that Andy was talking about in the initial phase of state formation in the Middle East continued to be the case throughout the process. This, in turn, exacerbated the insecurity of the current regimes, who then led to further authoritarian power, and that created a process that is still ongoing until the moment. However, it wasn't only about this. As regimes were trying to strengthen their power within their countries, they were more or less suppressing their enemies. What do you do in that case when you're living in a context of insecurity? You begin to rely on people from your own kin, sect, or tribe. That's almost, again, a factor that you can take into consideration when you study Libya, when you study Syria, when you study Iraq. Each of those leaders would begin to rely on people from his own kin, be it their tribe or sect, etc., etc. And these were installed in state institutions, which more or less led to regimes in the Middle East becoming what scholars who studied other regimes would call sultanistic regimes, regimes that rely on the personalistic rule of the leader. So students of Libya, for instance, recognized that as of the mid-1970s, the Libyan state, which was supposed to be a populist state coming to express the social and political grievances of Libyan society, begins to be a family state. Muammar Gaddafi felt threatened by his comrades to start with, later with other groups within society, and then he began to rely on his own region and own tribe within Libya, the Qaddafa tribe, but other tribes too. And in doing so, he began to establish what we would call a parallel state, a police state. When the regime collapsed, or when the civil war started in the last few months in Libya, the world began to talk about Qaddafi forces as opposed to rebels or pro-democracy forces. But studying state formation in Libya, that was the case since mid-1970, since 1975. The state turned into a private militia for Gaddafi. The same process, which I will not elaborate on at the moment, takes place in Iraq. By the late 1980s, it was Saddam Hussein's clan and later his own specific family that was in power, alienating different segments of society and establishing what you would call a family dynasty. In that case, republics, which were supposed to be the progressive forces in 1950s and 60s, suddenly become like monarchies in the region, i.e. family ruling over society and establishing power as a result. This, however, raises questions on how do we define the different paths of regime formation and regime erosion in the Arab world. In your introductory video this morning, we realized that the outcomes were quite different. So we can't talk about an Arab Spring as such, simply because in Egypt and Tunisia, you get a revolution, a regime is overthrown, or in the process of being overthrown, as in the case of Egypt. However, in Libya, you get international intervention. In Bahrain, you get a different kind of international intervention. You get an intervention that seeks to keep the regime intact, as opposed to the Libya case. In Yemen, you get a different outcome. It's a political solution, let alone in Syria, which is still ongoing. And I will make a small argument about Syria in the end. So to start with, this Arab world differs. Different cases, different histories, and most importantly, different social and cultural compositions. Excuse me. How and why question. Don't concentrate on this before I say something, because it can be a bit complicated. How do we differentiate between different states and different regimes? Why aren't we witnessing a true revolution as what happened in Eastern Europe, where most regimes, the Soviet kind of type of state collapsed, and you had new forces coming to the fore? This has to do with primarily two factors. One, domestic, which is always important because we're talking about revolutions. And the second factor is regional. Why is the world in a rush to change the regime in Syria but not in Bahrain? Well, that can't be answered based on domestic politics of Syria. You have to integrate the external factors. So generally speaking, one could divide the Arab world, again, at a very general level. You can divide the Arab world into two blocks: homogeneous states and heterogeneous states. And by homogeneous states, I simply mean states that share a common sectarian, religious, or ethnic composition. Think about Tunisia. The vast majority of the people are A, Arabs, B, Muslims, C, Sunni Muslims. Tunisia is also quiet, isolated, geopolitically speaking. So the transition in power wasn't a mere coincidence. It's not a coincidence that the change, the overthrowing of the regime in Tunisia and later Egypt was, relatively speaking, neat, as opposed to other bloody cases such as Libya, Syria, or Yemen, or let alone Iraq. So republics such as Egypt, a long history of statehood. In Egypt, there is no problem about the national identity. Egypt has been a state for 6,000 or 7,000 years, and the Egyptians have a strong sense of national identity. This is in opposition to states like Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria, where you got strong Arab nationalist roots historically, but also strong sectarian and ethnic divisions, primarily because of the way these states were more or less, the boundaries were more or less drawn early on in the 20th century. So for the Iraqis, Iraq as a modern state is quite artificial. For Syria, the same thing. Now, that's the domestic factors. We're thinking also about heterogeneous states. And then I have in the middle something called presidential monarchies, which that's what the system of Ben Ali in Tunisia and Hosni Mubarak's regime in Egypt came to. It was about really the central man and then the family. Let alone in the case of Egypt when Jamal Mubarak was ready to take power at one stage. It's a situation where, yeah, you start with Nasser, a populist leader, then you end in with Jamal Mubarak. So can you imagine the differences here? Then you have the monarchies, which I think it was mentioned in the morning too. There's always a talk about money. Why has Saudi Arabia, largely speaking, been quiet? One reason is that when regimes feel threatened, they tend to use strategies of survival that they're good at. So what do? Yes, you increase what we call the rentier state. Increase welfare to your citizens. Increase salaries, especially for civil servants. But then you call the religious establishment and ask them to issue a fatwa, a ruling guidance. What did the fatwa say? Simply put, people should not revolt. Why? Why not? It's not very important, but there you go. So in all of these Gulf states, you had the money. It's a rentier state, but it's not only about money. The Sauds, and I tend to agree with previous speaker who talked about the Saudi Arabia not being colonized initially. At least the current Saudi state is the third Saudi state, because the first one came in the 18th century. So there is a history there. And within Saudi Arabia, there is no social force that is strong enough to actually balance against Saudi Arabia. That's again, at the domestic level. In thinking about the outcomes, of course, I'm dealing with many cases here, but I'm happy to ask to answer your questions in detail if you have questions on a particular case. What we can observe that in the Arab world, monarchies, specifically the Gulf monarchies, but also Jordan and Morocco, are better at adapting to changes. And it's true, in Morocco, the king thought to diffuse power to an extent to the government. And that process, once again, did not start now. It started in the 1990s. Similarly, in the case of Jordan. So instead of being the target of rebellion, what do? You give some power to the executive branch, i.e. the government, and open the sphere for some democratic changes. In Saudi Arabia, as I said, certain mechanisms were re-employed, but once again, when we're talking about these regimes, it's not only about domestic factors. We have international interventions, and as the case of Syria shows, almost, I wouldn't be exaggerating if I said Syria could trigger a new Cold War, even probably it has already. We've seen two vetoes in the last 4 months, and China now steps in to also raise its hand in the Security Council. Where are we to go from now? i.e. what potential consequences are we thinking about when it comes to Arab regimes? First, we know from cases outside the region that democracy is never the quick outcome of revolutions. So if one is pretending Egypt to become the new Sweden, they'll have to wait a little bit. So in republics, homogeneous republics, you get revolutions for the reasons I talked about. Monarchies tend to adapt. I think the main threat to the monarchies, specifically those of the Gulf, comes from the middle classes. But I don't think they're ready to revolt. I don't think the Saudis or Kuwaitis are ready. Kuwait has a specific case too. Again, within this category, you need to compare a little bit. But still, the main threat would come against the regime. But the regime seems to have been trying to adapt, especially in Saudi Arabia, opening the sphere a little bit, providing women with some rights, and pretending to be leading a liberal kind of transition, although we need to be cautious about the word liberal. Then the most problematic cases are heterogeneous states. Ideally speaking, Syria, Iraq, there will probably lead to, on the long term, lead to consociational democracies, similar to the case of Lebanon. One only hopes that these cases would show more institutionalization as opposed to the case of Lebanon, a country that has freedom, but it's not necessarily a democracy. But in the short term, what I can see is a civil war. And the conditions for civil war as opposed to revolution, stated in sometimes poetic ways in Syria, the conditions for civil war are there. First, you have a regime that is trying to fight for its life. You have an opposition that is insisting on getting rid of the regime, and now it's being armed. So you have coercion. If you go back to the initial idea of monopolizing coercion, the regime is losing control over coercive forces. That's at the domestic level. At the regional level, you have two blocks of states unwilling to also reach a settlement. You have the Gulf states at the moment leading the opposition against Syria for reasons we can discuss during the Q&A. And then you have Iran, the Iraqi government, specifically the Shiite element in the Iraqi government, and Hezbollah in Lebanon trying to block any attempts at regime change in Syria without some guarantees. That's at the regional level. Then we reach probably the most important level. It's the international level. Here, China and Russia, and to a large extent, South Africa and Brazil and India are not in a hurry to lose a sphere of influence in the region. So they will not let another Libya occur in Syria. That's not an analysis. That's what the Russians said a few days ago. Then you have, on the other hand, Western powers led by the US, who would prefer to see the Bashar al-Assad regime gone, because that's going to weaken eventually Iran and its allies in the region, especially after the US withdrew from Iraq. And hence, the US feels its power in the region has diminished. Although, in alliance with Gulf states, one could argue that there is some delegation taking place at the moment. And it seems to me, at this stage, Turkey is a bit lost. Initially, they were very emotional about removing the regime and leading that revolution in Syria. But then they realized that the situation is a bit more complex, and hence they retreated a little bit and they're quieter at the moment. So where we're going from here, yes, we have the three broadest paths of political development. and taking into consideration the broader normative appeal of the revolution. So what's opening once again in the case of the Middle East is a century of social and political protest. So what you saw in the last year, in my opinion, will continue for a decade or two, to say the least. And it's a time when it's a different time in the sense that these states that were created as black boxes now are opening, and all the contradictions are coming out. Different ideologies from the extreme Islamic fundamentalist movements to women deciding to strip out their clothes and be naked as the girl did in Egypt. You have this polarization at the political, ideological, and socioeconomic levels. Do I have anything else? That's it. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. You mentioned a little bit about international interests, particularly regarding Syria, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit about what you see as China's interest in the region, in Syria specifically.
Thank you. Yeah, that's one level I talked about, but it would take really a whole lecture to discuss this, but I think it's very important. The fight for Syria, forget about the domestic factors, goes back to 1920s, simply because Syria, geographically speaking, Syria provides an access to the Mediterranean Sea, but potentially it's one of the two countries, if you add Jordan and Iraq, that link the Mediterranean to the Persian Gulf. So it's very important, not only for oil and its exportation, but it's also important because of the current regional divisions. The main camps at the moment at the regional level are, as I said during the talk, are Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah. Some have labeled this as the Shiite crescent. It works because the main actors happen to be the Shiites, although I'd say you need to focus more on the political aspects rather than the sectarian ones. So if you get rid of Bashar al-Assad's regime, you're already weakening that crescent, you're weakening that camp, and eventually isolating Iran in the region, which makes it vulnerable to potential regime change. On the other hand, that's an interest that also some elements in the Gulf are interested in too, because Saudi Arabia feels a little bit threatened at the moment. Actually, everyone feels threatened at the moment. That's why it's a bit chaotic. But Saudi Arabia feels threatened because of the Iranian expansion in the region, the change of power in Iraq, the prolonged chaos, potentially prolonged chaos in Yemen, let alone what's happening in Bahrain. That's really on the doorstep of, actually, it's a Saudi province, if you think about it, beyond the legal terms of states, etc. It just intervened, and that was it. So there is tension at the moment in the region between two camps. And these two camps are fighting until the end. From a Russian perspective, if you were a Russian strategist and you look at the map and you'd realize that you've just lost Libya, you've just lost, and before that you lost Iraq, and then your last ally in the region is the Syrian regime. And that's not only because of oil and the balance of power in the region, but because Syria really is of strategic importance for Russia. What separates Russia from Syria is only Turkey and the Black Sea. So if it loses this part of the Middle East, Russian power will quite diminish. And hence, that's, again, seeing this from a strategic perspective, the Russians would see this as a triumph for NATO forces which has implications on its own region. So that's the situation. These are the international and regional elements of the Syrian crisis, but we can talk about the domestic aspects if you want to. Yes?
So unique about the Arab monarchies, whether it's Morocco, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, that makes them so much more adaptable than the republics?
Excellent question. Well, to start with, as I mentioned, let's focus on Saudi Arabia, because even there are some comparisons within the Gulf, the Arab Gulf as such. First, this is a country that wasn't colonized. So when the founder of the Saudi state drew the borders in domestic struggles, he emerged as a status quo power, a conservative power. And his social base of support comes from the tribes. So it wasn't about nationalism, communism, socialism. No, it emerged from below, to start with. So it's part of the Saudi society, a minor tribe historically, but then it becomes the strong tribe. It moves on, and then two factors enter into the equation. First, oil. When you have vast amounts of oil income, you're able to buttress your own tribal power. And when we talk about tribal power, it's not only one tribe, but it's really in central Saudi Arabia, you have the Najdi area, which forms the social backbone of the regime. So you begin to bring your people to the state, and hence you reproduce power as such. The third factor is international protection. Just as Syria at the moment is a red line for the Russians, Saudi Arabia is a red line for the US and Britain, simply put. If that is lost, you can never guarantee what a big exporter of oil would be governed, or how it would be governed. So there are, many people think that the Saudi regime is weak. I don't think it's weak. It's quite strong, actually. And whether it's going to change or not, I don't see that in the short term. And it has the ability to adapt. Eventually, when you get a strong middle class, when socioeconomic conditions become dire, if they will, in the coming 50 years, then you'll have new social forces coming to the fore. But it's a rentier state. That's what rentier theory is. You import labor, you export oil. So what made this country democratic, for instance, is labor groups, labor federations, advancing new social claims. In Saudi Arabia, if a worker is angry, he's just deported to his country or her country. And therefore, you don't have the social base for potential threats for the regime. That's as opposed to republican regimes, which, as I said, started with very progressive ideas, but then they turned sectarian and tribal in themselves and have alienated society and created all this backlash that we're seeing at the moment. Questions? Yes, here, then. Okay, or two short ones.
My question is concerning Lebanon.
Yes.
So far, it seems to be, we can say to a certain extent, the most stable system in the Middle East. So what do you see is going to happen next? Are there going to be any uprisings soon, or is it going to become a model to other uprisings in the different regions?
Interesting with the case of Lebanon. It's usually seen as quite peculiar. To an extent, it is. Lebanon will not see a revolution or uprising because simply, who will you revolt against? in a country with, I don't want to say, there's 17 sects. You know that, or 18. Sorry, I missed one. 18 sects, but three major ones. So who would you rebel against? You can rebel against the confessional system, fair enough. Some people tried to do this, but it didn't work. So I'm afraid for Lebanon, it's business as usual. The elites there are waiting to see what's going to happen in Syria and base their strategies on that. And hence, the Lebanese are good at political adaptation, which could mean stability or it could mean chaos. And I think if the leadership in Lebanon is not conscious of these prospects, then the country will probably slide into chaos again, unfortunately. That will all be determined by what's happening in Syria. So no revolutions for Lebanon. But then they're always living in a revolution. You don't want more in Lebanon, probably. I don't want more, anyhow. Yeah. Yes, well, first you're right. It's one thing to have a revolution when you have the central figure actually going home and then you have a member of the military actually saluting the people. That's quite revolutionary to start with. But removing a regime is a different story. So this is a process. Unfortunately, revolutions, when they take place, they bring with them lots of excitement and expectations. Hence, people were saying, yeah, Egypt is going to turn. I heard people saying, Egyptian youth and elites saying, Egypt will be the strongest country in a few years. Well, it's not going to be the strongest, that's for sure. Because this is a long-term process. But I do see signs of the revolution. A, people's minds have changed. No more dictators, that's for sure. We're not going to return to a situation where you have one dictator imposing its will on society. Two, don't underestimate the quiet revolution that the Muslim Brothers are actually undertaking. They now have the parliament, and now they're talking about the government. Then the biggest obstacle is going to be the army. But that said, not all Egyptians agree that the army is threatening, because this is a main institution in the history of Egypt. You can't just tell the army, you know, go home and we're able to deal with the country. So the army continues to have some support. And I think in Egypt now the solution will be political rather than... But the big thing took place 1 year ago. And now it seems that it's a process and it might be long, unlike Tunisia. Okay, thank you.